This episode is brought to you by BundleRabbit.com, Earth's most accessible book bundling marketplace. Welcome to The Everyday Novelist. My name is J. Daniel Sawyer, author of 24 books, 34 short stories, and countless articles and scripts and essays, and I am your guide on this quest to raise your output to pulp speed levels and to explore the cracks and crevices of business and craft in the writing life. Welcome to part two of the age episode on deep characterization. And upon listening back to what I did last time, I realized I missed quite a lot of stuff. I don't know how I'm going to get it all in, but I will try to circle back around and fill in the gaps as I go forward here. So last thing we talked about was puberty and adolescence and the formation of identity, both sexual and cultural. I don't think I got into the cultural enough, but cultural identity is hugely formed here. This is where people are first figuring out how to interact with each other in a more adult world where the people around them are powerful and actually dangerous. There's all sorts of strategies that people employ, but this is the time when, generally speaking, people are discovering who and how they are going to be in the world. In the case of delayed development, this can get shifted forward into the next block, and you can get a lot of the rebellion and other craziness that generally happens during these years happening in full-on young adulthood. That only happens really generally in highly cosmopolitan societies where the traditional age categories and roles have broken down, and you haven't yet had new norms arise. We're in kind of this era right now in American culture. But these kinds of eras are generally transitory. There will be new norms because human biology is powerful and you can only outrun it for so long. The next phase after puberty and adolescence is young adulthood. And this is where people in our culture, this is where they enter their secondary and post-secondary education. And in most cultures, this is where you settle on your career and you get married off. If you're going to get married off, you tend to find your life partner. You tend to start to set the trajectory for the rest of your life. And it's not irrevocable, but actively looking to find your place in the world, that's what happens during this stage of development. The age it happens at comes a little earlier in primitive societies, comes a little later in industrialized and post-industrial societies, but it's that phase in which people are finding their place in the world. Well, this is where parenthood most commonly happens. And a few things happen when people have children at this age. First, they tend to have more of them than if they start later. Second, they tend to invest less in them than start later because they're busy doing all sorts of other stuff like climbing in the career, making sure the house is financially viable, even though it's kind of cash-strapped. So children of parents at this age have less supervision. And they tend to have less supervision and more siblings, which has all sorts of implications for how they grow up. They tend to be, on the upside, more adaptable, more resilient, less narcissistic, less neurotic and anxious, and less fragile. On the downside, they are at greater vulnerability for kidnapping, molestation, and other kinds of abuse at the hands of their peers, especially that happens outside of the adult supervision bubble. Puberty and young adulthood, and I know I'm sliding back and forth, but these are the last chances generally to set your risk tolerance. Generally, what you exit young adulthood with will be the highest risk tolerance you ever have, or close to the highest. After that, it goes down because you have more to lose as you get older. You have more money to lose. You have more life to lose. Not more life going forward, but more life going backward. The younger we are, the less we value the years we have left because the fewer we have accumulated so far. The older we get, the more we value the years we have left because we have a sense of history and investment in our own lives. Puberty and young adulthood are also where most people start to come in touch with their own mortality, especially outside of traditional or primitive societies. In traditional and primitive societies, mortality is woven into the cultural fabric, and it generally features as part of the initiation rites into adulthood that happen at the age of 12 to 14. But once you move out of that, whether you move out dramatically or whether you move out just a couple of degrees into financial comfort to where those kinds of initiation rites get spiritualized, and attached only to the religions and not to the culture as a whole, the whole death aspect tends to get really heavily tamped down. And so the awareness of one's own mortality has a delayed onset, comes later on in puberty or in young adulthood. Absent, of course, major personal experiences with death that happen early on. This is one of the reasons why people in this age group tend to behave as if they're immortal, or as if they think they're immortal, because, frankly, they kind of do. It's not that they don't know they're going to die, it's that they don't have a real connection between the fact that someday I'm going to die, and the emotional reality that someday everything that I am and everything I know will simply stop, and it will end. Whether it ends in nothingness, or whether it ends in an afterlife, everything that I value here is going to go away. That connection starts to happen for people when they have children. And if they don't have children, it happens when they have their first major experiences with death, people who are close to them. Sometimes it's a pet, more frequently it's the death of a friend, or a uncle, or a parent, or another close relative. Once you cross over that threshold, the whole way that life looks changes, and it's subtle, but it's very distinct. It adds one kind of urgency to life, but it takes away another kind. It takes away a lot of existential uncertainty, because you now know what the end game is. On the other hand, you don't want it to happen. So it's kind of bad news that still makes the world a little more of a peaceful place for you. And this particular dynamic gets repeated in midlife, because in midlife, as your children are growing up, and as you're hitting the peak of your physical condition and you're starting to notice aches and pains showing up, you start to feel mortality in a whole new way. And making life count becomes a lot more urgent for you than it was before. In young adulthood, you want to make life count because you want to prove yourself. You want to prove that you're worthy of a good place in society, of a good salary, of having the respect of your peers and the attention of the opposite sex or of the same sex if you're attracted to same-sex people. It's all about making your life look valuable enough to other people to be worth investing in. The midlife crisis is all about making sure your life is valuable enough to yourself to be worth continuing in the face of ongoing decay. So the emotional makeup of a midlife crisis is a lot different than the emotional makeup of the coming-of-age crisis. Now, once we move out of young adulthood, once you're past about 25, you move into 25 to 35, 25 to 40, you move into your peak productivity years. This is when everything works well. Your body's the best it's ever going to be. And again, all this is all things being equal. There's some people who hit their peak later, some people who hit it earlier. This is when your body is the best it's going to be. It's when your status as a vital builder in society is attains the highest places it's going to be. Your wealth is not the highest it's going to be, but your lifestyle may be the richest that it will ever be. If you have kids, you're seriously focused on making sure they launch well. If you don't have kids, you're trying desperately during this period to find something else to invest your life in because you don't have the prepackaged answer. And if you want kids but don't have them, this is the time during which that becomes a real problem. And it upends marriages, and it sends people, both men and women, into major depression if they are unable to have children but want them. And that's true whether they're unable biologically or unable financially or for other reasons. Don't underestimate the parenting drive. Even most people with no kids have a serious parenting drive, and they'll vent it on acolytes, mentees, adopted younger siblings, maybe real younger siblings, nieces and nephews, and pets or businesses. When you watch Shark Tank and you see a middle-aged woman talking about how this business is her baby, she's not kidding. That's what she's putting her parenting energy into. The major creative energy for the early to midlife period is going into that business. And so it has the same place in her emotional pantheon as a child would, or if she has children, as a child does. For men, it's usually a little bit different. There's something similar going on, but men are continually trying to prove themselves worthy of the attention of their mates and their peers. So that status-seeking drive stays in play for men all the way up into late life. So when men invest in something like that, it's not so much their child as it is their life. When men in young adulthood have a major career change, it's relatively easy for them to pick themselves up, dust themselves off, and go on. that gets harder the later in life they get, unless they deliberately cultivate that ability. And that's because the later in life they get, the more their entire retrospective view of themselves is colored by their current circumstances. If they're doing well, they see themselves as being a success. And if they're doing poorly, they see everything in their life as having been a waste. And that's why men in midlife crises can dive so deep into the depression pit. And if they're not in a career that has a professional fraternity about it, like a genuine profession or a soldier or something like that, that doesn't have a professional fraternity about it, it can be a lot worse, because they don't have the kind of social network to support themselves that women tend to accrue by default. It's one of the reasons, one of the non-sinister reasons that men form clubs and professional associations and veterans get together in veterans halls and that sort of thing. It's because men tend to form their core support group out of their peers and colleagues, whereas women tend to form it out of their family and friends. It's a strange thing, and again, talking norms here, you're going to find men and women at different points along both of these, but talking norms, the reason that the stereotypical smoke-filled room exists is that for many men, that's all they had that they really cared about. The wealth that they accrued and the power that they accrued were incidental to the solidarity that they were able to command from their peers and the attention they were able to command from the objects of their fraternal affections and sexual desires. So that gets us through midlife. Other things that happen in midlife, I talked a little bit about people wanting to have children. The later in life you get as a parent, the more valuable your children get, and the less freedom they have growing up, and the more material wealth they have growing up. So they get more and more privileged on about the same scale as they get less and less able to exercise that privilege in a way that advantages them as individuals as opposed to as part of an extended family or social network. This is one of the reasons that Andrew Carnegie didn't give any appreciable inheritance to his offspring, because he had seen the devastating developmental effect that that kind of privilege had had on his peers' children. And so instead, everybody in the world became his child by getting the Carnegie Libraries. Also, children who have older parents tend, when they're younger, to idolize them more, and when they're older, to respect them less, because as they become teenagers, the older parents are more and more out of touch. And when they're younger, the older they are, the more wizened and unassailable their opinions and positions seem to be. And so the adolescence process for children of older parents can be a lot more wrenching than it is for children of younger parents. On the other hand, older parents tend to be a lot more relaxed about adolescence because they don't have the sense of competing with their children for status that younger parents, particularly younger fathers, frequently do. They don't have to have a power struggle. They already know they've won. They've made their place in the world, and their children are not a threat to it. And so they can have a much more laid-back attitude about teenage rebellion compared to younger parents who tend to get really bent out of shape about it. Now, your peak years for earning and professional competency run up until you're about 45, maybe 50 years old currently. After that, you enter middle age, where everything is on the decline, and we've already talked a lot about that, but through this whole period of midlife and middle age, a lot of things decline. Your health declines, your resistance to disease declines, your energy levels decline, your fertility levels decline, your ability, if you can conceive a child, to have a healthy one declines. But on the other hand, a lot of things advance. Generally, your earning power advances quite a bit over these two periods. And generally, midlife crises aside, your contentment with who you are as a person and your place in the world and your command of the world and your understanding of the world get a lot better, which means that if the world shifts underneath you, like the world is currently shifting underneath all of us, if you are older than about 45 or 50 years old, it's a real problem. You can really see this reading firsthand accounts of World War II, particularly from Jews in Europe, but also from middle-aged and older folks in World War I and World War II in Britain, because a lot of these records survive. Those times of major world transition were much, much harder on the older folks in the mix, because they had spent a lifetime acquiring wisdom about how to cope with the way the world all always was, and now suddenly everything in the world is up for grabs. They don't know how to navigate legally, culturally, financially, pragmatically. The manners change so that what was polite a generation ago is now rude. It is tremendously difficult for people who are in midlife and later to adapt to major changes in the world, because they've spent decades acquiring expertise for dealing with a situation that simply doesn't exist anymore. The other thing that starts happening once you're exiting midlife is that you start to lose people. Death becomes an ever-present reality of life. It usually starts with your parents, but it's not too long before it starts to eat up your friends and your enemies. Depending on your personality, this can be a good thing or a bad thing. On the one hand, there's the sensation that some people talk about walking through a graveyard. Everybody I know is dead. Then there's people who are a little more ornery, who look around and notice that everyone they hate is dying. And they're really happy about that. Time wounds all heals, they say, rather than time heals all wounds. And so the reaction to that phenomenon can be very, very different depending on one's general personality and social standing. But all other things being equal, the ramp up in death and sadness and tragedy doesn't generally affect how much people enjoy life. Generally speaking, the older you get, the better your life is. There are exceptions brought on by extreme loss, extreme poverty, whatnot. But most of the time, you ask someone who's over about 60 years old if they would go back and change anything, they'll be much less likely to say yes than if they were 40 or if they were 30. The older you get, the more comfortable you get with accepting yourself for who you are and owning the responsibility for your choices and enjoying access to the world provided to you by the wisdom that you have really suffered to earn. Now, after that, we get your twilight years. 70 years old plus. Again, a lot more death. But also, in traditional societies, anyone actually over about 60 has a lot of power, a lot of social power, because they know everything. These are the women who teach the young women how to deal with childbirth and menarche and parenting and hunting and gathering and managing a household and all the things that are prescribed to their gender role. These are the men who finance the younger men's business ventures, who employ them, who take them on as proteges, who are the generals that command the soldiers on the battlefield, who strategize and who have all the power in keeping the borders of the society safe, while the older women have all the power in keeping the internal order of the society working. And that's generally how gender roles shake out in pre-industrial societies everywhere. And the relative power of men and women depends on the relative importance of defending the borders versus ordering the internal affairs of the society. The further you move along the industrialization scale, the less place there is for old people, the less powerful they get, the less respect they get, the more they tend to be regarded as human detritus, in all areas except for healthcare, where they're immensely profitable. And so that can be a source of some major existential anxiety for people in the older age brackets going forward if they don't have strong relationships with their families. If they have a good solid family group or a good solid peer group like veterans, like, for example, veterans or actors or something like that, people who practice a rarefied profession that requires a lot of high sociality. If they don't have that, they don't have much of anything, and their life is full at the same time of as much possibility as they had when they were a teenager, and as well as all the dangers and tragedies they have to face as an old person. And depending on the basic personality, this can push them to one extreme or the other. Sexual activity, especially among people who are not romantically involved with each other, skyrocket, especially post age 65. Because they no longer have to worry about keeping families together. If they're monogamous, they've been with their partner forever, and they're interested in exploring and experimenting. And marriages at this age that go that direction are a little more likely to survive than marriages that try to do that at a younger age. Because you're at an age where sex really doesn't mean anything. It doesn't have any other consequences other than the disease risk. Which is why you see a fantastic amount of STDs in old folks' homes. But they become very much their own little civilization encapsulated in a larger, broader civilization if they don't have a family context to keep them rooted. And for some of them, this is fantastic, and for others, this is a great tragedy and a source of endless sorrow, and suicide rates start to climb at this age as well. Now I'm going to step back and talk a little more about economics here, because the economics of the different demographics really influence the shape of the broader society. When you're young, you spend a lot of money. When you're in your young adulthood, you are in the consumer class, young adulthood and your middle years. You're in the consumer class. Your earning power is low. Your needs are high. You tend to spend a lot more than you bring in. You get student loans, mortgages, car loans, credit card debt. And that is made possible by a smaller generation in front of you. And they're smaller because as people grow, they tend to die. So there's almost always fewer people a generation up than there are a generation down. They are planning for retirement. They're investing and lending their money. And so their capital provides the credit base that you're drawing from. They also pay most of the taxes because they're spending less and earning and investing more. They're not getting the benefit of mortgage interest deductions, per-child tax credits, all the other stuff that happens in mixed economies. Then, about age 60 to 65, their capital gets pulled out of the market to finance their retirement. They don't want the risk that it comes with being in the market, so they convert their investments to holding assets like real estate, gold, treasury bills, cash, annuities, things like that. And in doing that, they're pulling their capital from the market. Meanwhile, the tax-paying class, those between the ages of about 40 and 60, are paying the taxes that finance the Social Security and Medicare, or whatever the analogous thing is in your country, of the retirees. This is the way the world has been organized in all Western countries to one extent or another since World War II. If that demography flips,
you get an interesting set of economic circumstances. You get a situation in which interest rates are low and inflation stays low, where tax receipts are incredibly high relative to the tax burden, where you get runaway booms because you have so many middle-aged and older people chasing investment that their attempts to get a return on capital just drops the price of money and makes anything even vaguely attractive go through the ceiling in terms of its price, when the fundamental value of that thing doesn't really justify it. This should sound familiar to you about now. You get, because this is exactly the situation we've been in as a planet for the last 20, 30 years or so. The problem with a demographic flip is there is always a crash afterwards, and there's a big crash, because when a demography flips, what it means is that your older generations are substantially larger than your younger ones. So as the older generation starts to pull its credit out of the market, suddenly your asset prices start to reground in reality, inflation goes up, invariably they age out and they start to pull their money out and go to those safe holding assets I was talking about. And when that happens, prices crash back to earth because the demand for the things that they were financing, because the demand for things goes way down. And And it's not being propped up by cheap credit anymore. So some things will get radically cheaper very quickly. Other things will get radically more expensive very quickly. Particularly, the price of money goes way up. So credit slows down. And when credit slows down, economic growth stalls out. And this is what is starting to happen around the world. This is happening right now in Europe. It's about to happen in China. It'll happen a little bit later in the U.S., and it'll be a softer landing in the U.S. because the U.S. is one of three or four industrialized economies that has another boom generation after the Gen X group. And so the crash will be happening just about the time the millennials are hitting their peak consumption years, and so that'll be softened. Everywhere else, not so much, and that's going to be interesting. But if you want to learn about how to do world building and incorporate demography into things, watch the world economy over the next 5 to 10 years. It will be an incredible laboratory experiment because this has only happened a couple of times in history. And what generally happens after the big depression caused by the collapse of the credit markets, which is caused by radical depopulation, is economic growth, a baby boom, and a whole rebalancing of things. This is what happened after the Black Death. and after the Napoleonic Wars, for example. Now, the question is whether it'll happen this time, because this time, there's the birth control pill. And that's projected by demographers to keep the population low, in which case you'll have a rebalancing across a more or less static population level, a rebalancing of wealth and productivity that will have some significant cultural effects that aren't entirely predictable. And depending on your point of view, it may wind up being good or bad. It's probably going to be a mix from everybody's point of view. But as you're designing your cultures, keep demography in mind, because the ratio of old people to older workers, to middle age, to younger workers, to children, all affects the prospects and economic position of the people in those various groups, even if the character you're dealing with is bucking the trend. Anyway, I think that about does it for deep characterization on age. Come back next time when I'll be talking about the five-factor model of personality and the ways you can use it to measure and help define your characters and understand what their responses to different things are likely to be, especially if they have different personalities from you. Hope that was helpful, and I'll see you tomorrow.
The Everyday Novelist is written and presented by J. Daniel Sawyer and is produced by Artistic Whispers Productions. Visit our website at everydaynovelist.com and leave a tip in the tip jar or join the Patreon to support this podcast. The Everyday Novelist is copyright 2017 J. Daniel Sawyer and Artistic Whispers Productions, Inc. and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives License.